Welcome to another episode of PhD Binem Beyond the Lab. Today we'll explore the fascinating world of the rare disease of the central nervous system. Let's begin. I'm Elisa Chiadini and I work at the Molecular Diagnostic Unit of the Bioscience Laboratory at Erste Mildola, a hospital where research and treatment in oncology are strictly connected. Indeed, oncologists and researchers collaborate closely in clinical case discussion and research projects. Specifically, I deal with molecular biology related to solid tumors sent to the laboratory for molecular characterization as requested by oncologists for therapeutic management. From this premise, my PhD project, titled Molecular Characterization of Central Nervous System Tumors and Research of New Biomarkers Using SGS Panel, was born. The project primarily aims to characterize a case series of CNS tumors by combining biological results with histological ones. Especially, tumor analyzed in my project include astrocytomas, glioblastomas, and oligodendrogliomas. Astrocytomas originate from astrocytes, and they are distinguished in three classes of different grades, from benign to more aggressive and malignant form. Glioblastomas represent the most malignant form of glioma, derived from grade 4 astrocytomas or with the de novo origin. It's one of the most common brain tumors in adults, characterized by a very high mortality, also because tumoral mass vascularizes quickly and has a progressive degeneration around 2 or 3 months. Finally, oligodendrogliomas originate from oligodendrocytes, and like astrocytomas, they are divided in different classes of grades, from benign to malignant, but generally grows more slowly than other brain tumors. Based on this very broad differentiation of CNS tumors, the purpose of correlation between histological and biological results could be useful for better defining the diagnosis already established in an initial step by pathologists and subsequently assisting oncologists in determining the best therapeutic strategy to follow. The analyses are performed using the NGS technique with a panel of 161 genes, including both target genes for possible diagnosis confirmation and other genes to correlate emerging new markers with therapy response prediction and disease prognosis. Indeed, guidelines recommend ADH1 and 2 genes analysis, suggested as a gold standard marker with both diagnostic and predictive roles. On the other hand, new possible markers to be considered as a second step of analysis are ATRX, CDK N2A, PTEN, and TP53 genes, TERT promoter, and EGFR amplification. This group of biomarkers has a prognostic role and will discriminate different classes of tumor revealing the grade of neoplasia. Like other solid carcinoma, solid tumors, CNS tumors are characterized by prognostic and predictive markers constantly expanding. This is why the RELIVE classification also provides more specific clinical trial and even more personalized treatment regimens. Finally, this case series and all the results obtained will be correlated with the clinical data to understand the concordance between the identified variants and the patient clinical outcome.
Hi everyone, I'm Martina Bedeschi and I work at the Biosciences Laboratory at Erste in Mildola. In our research group focused on brain tumors and in vitro models, both 2D and 3D, and also in vivo models. Like Elisa mentioned, at Erste, research and clinical practice go hand in hand with a strong collaboration between researchers and oncologists to improve patients' outcomes. While Elisa's project focuses on the molecular characterization of different central nervous system tumors, my research delves deeper into glioblastoma, the most aggressive and common primary malignant brain tumor in adults. One of the key aspects of glioblastoma is its extreme heterogeneity, making it a highly complex disease to study and treat. Glioblastoma originates from glial cells, particularly the astrocytic lineage, which plays a crucial role in supporting and protecting neurons. Despite intensive treatment strategies, including surgical resection, radiotherapy, and chemotherapy, the prognosis remains extremely poor, with a median survival of less than 15 months from the diagnosis. There are several ways to study glioblastoma. For example, one approach is the molecular characterization, as Elisa described, which helps in understanding the genetic landscape of the tumor. For instance, the presence of IDH1 and IDH2 mutation is a crucial prognosis marker, as patients with this mutation tend to respond better to therapy and also have a long survival compared, of course, to those with wild-type tumors. However, my research focuses on another critical aspect, the genetic alteration and signaling pathways driving glioblastoma progression. This tumor is characterized by constant genetic variation, including mutation, deletion, and also chromosomal rearrangements. Among these, gene fusions have gained increasing attention, in recent years, as they can lead to the formation of aberrant protein with altered function, contributing to tumor development. Understanding and classifying such genetic alteration, especially oncogenic gene fusion, is crucial for developing targeted therapies. Indeed, my project aims to identify and validate these fusions as a potential therapeutic targets. The research is structured into three main phases. First, I analyze existing literature and databases such as MESH, PubMed, and RNA-seq to study already known gene fusions. Then I extract and sequence fresh tissue samples and patient-derived cell lines to identify potential fusions unique to glioblastoma and compare them with the healthy sample through computational analysis. Once the promising candidates emerge, I refine the computational analysis, thanks also to the help of our bioinformatics, and validate the findings by cross-referencing leukemia databases. The most relevant gene fusions are then confirmed through capillary sequencing and with an orthotopic patient-derived xenograft model in mice, which is established to further investigate their biological relevance. In fact, in my group of research, we are able to create a glioblastoma mice model by injecting patient-derived cells inside mice brain. After injection, the growth of the tumor is checked weekly by IVS technique. In the final phase, I engraft the patient-derived GBM cells carrying validated drug ball fusion into the PDOX model. And then pharmacological tests are conducted both in vitro and in vivo to evaluate the therapeutic potential of targeting these fusions. Lastly, biomolecular analysis is performed on explanted organs to assess the effectiveness of the treatments. In conclusion, by integrating molecular profiling with the functional studies, this project aims to discover novel gene fusions that can serve as actionable therapeutic targets. In the long term, this research could pave the way for more personalized and effective treatment strategies for GBM patients. Thank you so much for this opportunity and for the listening.
Hello everyone, my name is Alessandro and I work in the laboratory of neurogenetics at Bellaria Hospital, which specializes in the study of rare mitochondrial diseases. Mitochondrial diseases are a group of genetic diseases caused by mutation in mitochondrial or nuclear DNA. Affected genes code for structural or functional mitochondrial protein, leading to mitochondrial dysfunction. Since mitochondria play a key role in cellular metabolism, these cells usually affect multiple highly energetic systems such as brain, heart, and skeletal muscle. In the last 2 years, I've been working on MELAS, mitochondrial encephalomyopathy, lactic acidosis, and stroke-like episode syndrome, a rare mitochondrial disease usually associated with a point mutation in a mitochondrial gene coding the tRNA for leucine. This mutation hinders mitochondrial protein synthesis and can consequently lead to defects in the respiratory chain and ATP production. Since mitochondria are passed from mother to son, this disease is maternally hereditated. Symptoms include short stature, muscle weakness, hearing loss, encephalomyopathy, and recurrent stroke-like episodes. The latter, unlike vascular stroke, are caused by metabolic crises that can lead to permanent brain damage and multi-organ failure. Circulating cell-free mitochondrial DNA consists in fragments or sometimes whole empty DNA molecules released in the bloodstream. This may happen due to apoptosis, necrosis, and active transport, and due to its low concentration, it is usually detected via qPCR or ddPCR. So, since blood sampling is not invasive, circulating cell-free mitochondrial DNA can be considered as a suitable biomarker for cellular death in neurodegeneration. In a previously published paper from our laboratory, an increased mtDNA outflow was demonstrated in plasma derived from MLS patients. However, due to ethical and practical reasons, it is impossible to study molecular pathogenic mechanisms directly on patients. So, to bypass these issues, as Elisa and Martina, I performed my experiment using a cellular model. Via biopsy, we isolated patient-derived skin cells, called fibroblasts, and cultured them in vitro. This way, we can study molecular mechanisms directly on patient-derived cells, so maintaining the same genetic background, and by performing a minimally invasive procedure without violating ethical principles. In our case, we investigate the role of mtDNA release in MLS phenotype, and even though the results obtained so far are really encouraging, fibroblasts do not accurately reproduce the target tissues of this disease, namely neurons and muscles. But unfortunately, this cell type cannot be directly cultured in lab, since it requires invasive procedures and do not have self-renewal capacity, crucial for in vitro studies. To overcome this obstacle, my PhD project will focus on generating 2D and 3D neuronal cellular models. In order to do so, I will transfect patient-derived fibroblasts with Yamanaka factors, four genes coding for transcription factors that can reprogram a somatic cell into an induced pluripotent stem cell. These cells, as their name might suggest, can be differentiated into several target cells, and I will differentiate them into neuroprecursor cells and cortical brain organoids. Neuroprecursor cells are neural committed, so they can differentiate into neurons, oligodendrocytes, and astrocytes, while maintaining self-renewal capacities, so the most fitting model for this disease. Instead, cortical brain organoids are a three-dimensional cellular structure with neural seed architecture that allow us to study cell-to-cell and cell-to-environment interaction as they happen in vivo. After characterization to confirm the differentiation in both models, I will study the role of mtDNA release in MLS phenotype and the pathways involved via ddPCR, CORS analyzer, Western blot, immunofluorescence, and other techniques.
My name is Penelope, and like Alessandro, I work at Neurogenetic Laboratory at Bellaria Hospital in Bologna, which is involved in the study of rare mitochondrial diseases in the field of neurology. Over the past 3 years and performing various roles, I've come across a variety of projects, among which the main one and the one that I will continue to pursue during my PhD is the investigation of the role of OPA1 in dominant optic atrophy. Dominant optic atrophy is a neurodegenerative disease characterized by bilateral degeneration of the optic nerve, selectively affecting retinal ganglion cells. It is responsible for vision loss that generally begins in childhood and can progress to blindness in adulthood. Prevalence is variable, ranging from 1/10,000 in Denmark due to a founder effect to 1/35,000 in the rest of the world. Transmission is autosomal dominant. Color vision is often affected, usually but not always, the blue-yellow axis. Diagnosis is hypothesized in children who present with apparently unexplained optic neuropathy. Examination of the ocular fundus usually shows bilateral symmetrical pallor on the temporal side of the optic nerve head, pallor of the optic nerve surround, and the presence of a gray temporal crescent. Usually visual evoked potentials are delayed. optical coherence tomography shows a generalized reduction in the thickness of the peripapillary retinal nerve fiber layer, especially in the infrotemporal quadrant, while the rest of the retina is usually normal. The diagnosis is confirmed by OPA1 gene screening. Other hereditary optic neuropathies, such as hereditary Leber optic neuropathy and Wolfram syndrome, are characterized by late-onset clinical signs and possible association with other neurological or systemic symptoms, but the final clinical phenotype of optic neuropathy is non-specific. Pathogenetically, it is a mitochondriopathy, and the prevalent cause of this disease is associated with mutations in the OPA1 gene, which is responsible for encoding a GTPase belonging to the dynamin family, which is required for inner mitochondrial membrane fusion, anchoring of mitochondrial DNA to the inner mitochondrial membrane, closure of mitochondrial cristae, and moreover. In relation to the different domains of OPA1 affected by the mutation, different forms of DOA are known, from the classical to the plus phenotype, which presents worse symptomatology with extraocular symptoms. Despite countless studies on this condition, to date, the exact mechanism of work is unknown, and there is no preventive or curative treatment of DOA. Pharmacological treatments have little efficacy and are limited to the off-label use of idebenone, while gene therapy is under development and difficult to be applied due to the presence of 8 isoforms of the OPA1 gene. Therefore, further studies are needed to better understand the causes and modes of intervention. Specifically, my PhD project is divided into 2 main parts. On the one end, I will attempt to elucidate the role of OPA1 in relation to mitochondrial DNA replication, as studies previously conducted here in recent years have shown that the absence of OPA1 and the presence of DOA plus associated mutations seem to involve inefficient mtDNA restoration, whereas the other approach will be therapeutic and will be based on the study of different types of molecules, anti-inflammatory and heteroglycerophospholipid, used in both fibroblasts from patients with the disease and target cells, NPCs and RGCs of the disease derived from patient-generated iPSCs. In particular, the main morphological and phenotypic features of the mitochondrial network, mitochondrial respiration, mitochondrial DNA copy number will be analyzed as all indicative of proper mitochondrial function.
Hello everyone, I am Santino Blando and I'm doing my first year of PhD at the Cell Signaling Laboratory in the Center of Clinical, Surgical, Experimental and Molecular Anatomy. My PhD is in collaboration with the Bellaria Hospital, where I started working 2 years ago. Due to the nature of my research, I attend the labs of both facilities, where I met Alessandro and Penelope. My projects aim to understand how mitochondrial gastrointestinal encephalomyopathy, also known as MINGI, works. To better understand MINGI, we needed to know how the mitochondrial aspect of the disease affects the system involved. This requires a team of different specialists to focus on the different aspects of it. One of the main challenges of studying MINGI is that there are very few patients. This forces us to work with different hospitals around the world. MINGI is an ultra-rare autosomal recessive multisystemic disease caused by mutations in the TIMP gene, which encodes the thymidine phosphorylase enzyme, also known as TP. Mutation in TIMP reduce or abolish TP activity, leading to the accumulation of toxic nucleosides. This leads to MT depletion, that is basically a lower number of mitochondrial DNA. While other mitochondrial diseases affect not only muscle cells and or neurons,
This disease affects also the gastrointestinal system. Meningi is highly debilitating and is usually leads to death during the third decade of life. Liver transplant appeared to be a possible solution to restore TP activity, eliminating the toxic nucleosides and restore the mtDNA. However, the patient's follow-up showed almost no change in the chronic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, a type of intestinal dysmotility, and leukoencephalopathy. This led us to study different aspects of the diseases, not only focusing on the mitochondrial aspects. TP is also known as platelet-derived endothelial cell growth factor because the 2-deoxy-D-ribose-1-phosphate producing during nucleoside conversion act as a chemotactic agent that induce endothelial progenitor cell to form and repair blood vessels. We showed the vessels in the intestine are smaller than normal, which explain the persistence of gastrointestinal symptoms. This can also mean that leukoencephalopathy persist for the same reason. Moreover, vascular dysfunction also highlight a clear issue in the gut vascular barrier. Although the liver has never been described as a target organ of the disease, explanted liver from Meningi patients show evident microscopic alterations. This is therefore essential to clarify the microanatomical, molecular and metabolic integrity. We also saw the loss of 70% of enteric neurons in Meningi patients suggests a possible neurotoxicity linked to the absence of TP. This study aims to clarify the role of microvascular and neuronal alterations in the genesis of gastrointestinal symptoms in these conditions. The multidisciplinary approach adopted not only seeks to achieve a deeper understanding of complex gastrointestinal dysmotility, but also aims to develop targeted therapeutic strategies, finally improving the quality of life for patients affected by this debilitating disease.
Hello everyone, I'm Davide Mascarella, neurologist at the Institute of Neurological Sciences in Bologna. I work in the neurology unit, more specifically within the headache center, where my clinical and research activity focuses on two main areas: primary headache disorders such as migraine, cluster headache, and cerebrospinal fluid or CSF circulation disorder, conditions such as the idiopathic intracranial hypertension or IIH, and spontaneous intracranial hypotension. Today I want to share some details about my ongoing research project, which focuses on the idiopathic intracranial hypertension, a condition that's both challenging and still somewhat mysterious from a pathophysiological point of view. So what exactly is IIH? This is a neurological disorder characterized by chronically elevated intracranial pressure without any identifiable cause on standard neuroimaging or laboratory testing. Clinical presentation may vary widely among patients. It can include headache, visual disturbances, pulsatile tinnitus, occasionally cranial nerve deficits. Mechanisms behind the IIH are still debated. Several hypotheses have been proposed, including impaired cerebral venous outflow, such as bilateral venous stenosis, increased resistance to the CSF outflow at the arachnoid granulation, alteration in the glymphatic CSF drainage, but also hormonal imbalances, abnormalities in the vitamin A metabolism. Interestingly, although some research have speculated on the involvement of the lymphatic system, to date, no studies have specifically addressed lymphatic dysfunction in IIH, and that's where our project comes in. Our aim is to explore the potential link between the lymphatic system and IIH using a relatively recent non-invasive MRI-based technique called the DTI ALPS, which stands for diffusion tensor image along the perivascular spaces. This method was introduced by Taoka and colleagues in 2017 and offers an indirect way to study the lymphatic system by analyzing the diffusion of water molecules in the brain. Let me try to explain how this works. At the level of the lateral ventricles in the brain MRI, brain white matter tracts have a highly organized structure. So we're talking about axonal fibers, and we can divide them in three main sections. So we have the projection fibers that run in the head-to-toe direction. Then we have associative fibers that run in the front-to-back direction, and subcortical fibers that predominantly run in the left-to-right direction. On the other hand, perivascular spaces where the lymphatic system operates are oriented orthogonally to these major fiber tracts. This kind of unique anatomical setup allows us to measure water diffusion along the perivascular spaces. So basically, we acquire the MRI and generate the fractional anisotropy map derived from the diffusion tensor imaging. Then we place the ROI of region of interest. So basically, in other words, we decide where specifically to do the calculation, and then we calculate diffusion values of water molecules along the X, the Y, and the Z axis for each fiber type. The ALPS index is then calculated as a ratio of diffusivity components that are perpendicular to the dominant direction of the fiber tracts. And this indirectly allows us to study the functionality of these lymphatic pathways. In our protocol, we're applying the DTI ALPS technique before and after a lumbar puncture that indicated of IIH is a both diagnostic and therapeutic procedure. The idea is to assess whether reducing intracranial pressure has any measurable impact on lymphatic activity and whether dysfunction in the system might play a role in IIH pathophysiology. So far, we screened 25 patients, but the protocol is complex, require precise coordination and timing, since each participant undergo an advanced brain MRI with angiographic sequences and diffusion tensor imaging, followed by a lumbar puncture with CSF pressure measurement, and then a second MRI is performed within 10 days from the lumbar puncture to assess any changes. To date, 14 patients have completed the full protocol. We've established a close collaboration with the Functional Neuroradiology Unit at the Institute of Neurological Science in Bologna, which has been essential both for optimizing the imaging workflow and for the post-processing of data. We're also working together on the manuscript that will report our findings, and in parallel, since working with DTI ALPS made us understand some potential drawbacks to this method, we're conducting a scoping review of the DTI ALPS method to assess how widely it's been used in clinical research and to clarify its strengths and its limitation in evaluating lymphatic function. The motivation behind this project came from a clear gap in the literature. IIH remains a poorly understood condition. The lymphatic system offers a new underexplored pathway that could help us uncover some of the mechanisms at play, potentially maybe opening up new avenues for diagnosis and treatment. And with that, we wrap up today's episode. Thank you for joining us on this journey. Stay tuned for more episodes for PhD BNM Beyond the Lab podcast. Until next time.